Welcome to Tech Humanity, the weekly podcast where philosopher of technology Tony Kashani examines the intersection between technology and humanity. In the 21st century, the so-called digital age, ones and zeros tend to determine much of what we call reality. Do you ever question the nature of your reality? Do you ever wonder how new technologies, things like social media, apps for humanistic ideas, and so on, shape your consciousness? Will AI become an extension of our consciousness? Are we in charge of technology, or is technology in charge of us? Will singularity become a reality, and AI become the new creator, competing directly with the metaphysical God? These are some of the ideas and questions educator, author, cultural critic, and philosopher of technology, Dr. Tony Kashani, will examine in this episode and many more in the future. So please join us in Tech Humanity.
Hello, friends. I'm your host, Tony Kashani. What happens when the things we create begin to reflect who we are? Not just our functions, but our feelings. Not just our needs, but our consciousness. In this episode of Tech Humanity, I want to explore that idea, not through technical jargon, but through stories, because sometimes the oldest myths are the clearest mirrors. We're going to revisit two ancient tales, one of longing and love, the other of rebellion and fire. Then we'll turn to our present myth, the age of artificial intelligence. Together, they might reveal something profound about how we think, how we create, and whether our consciousness is something we own or something we're always sharing. Now, the stories. In ancient Cyprus, in a time when gods still wandered through cities and prayers were whispered into olive trees, there lived a sculptor named Pygmalion. He was no ordinary artisan. He was renowned not only for his skill with the chisel, but for his withdrawal from human connection, especially from women. The stories say that Pygmalion had grown disgusted by what he saw as moral corruption in the women of his society. He thought that they were cursed by Aphrodite and had lost their sense of shame. Whether this was misogyny, heartbreak, or ascetic idealism, the result was the same. Pygmalion turned inward. He resolved never to love a woman. Instead, he would create one. And so he took up a block of pure ivory and began to carve not just an image of beauty, but his ideal, a woman who would never betray, never speak back, never change. His hands followed the lines of his desire, the contours of her cheeks, the curve of her arms, the gentle slope of her neck. She emerged not just as an artwork, but as a fantasy sculpted into matter. He named her Galatea, meaning she who is milk white. But what began as craftsmanship turned quickly into obsession. Pygmalion began to treat her as if she lived. He placed her in soft clothes, brought her gifts, sang her songs, and caressed her cold cheek. He whispered to her, not because he believed she would reply, but because he could not stop himself. In private, he kissed her lips. In public, he spoke of her beauty as though it were divine. On the day of Aphrodite's festival, Pygmalion walked alone to the temple and made a quiet prayer. "Goddess, grant me a wife like my ivory girl." But Aphrodite, moved or amused by the strange sincerity from Pygmalion, decided to do something more. She stepped silently into the sculptor's lonely house and touched the statue with her golden warmth. That evening, as Pygmalion kissed Galatea one more time, her lips softened, her eyes blinked, her hand moved, and she started to breathe. The statue had come to life. They would marry, according to some versions, and have a child named Pappus, from whom the city got its name. But the myth leaves a question lingering like incense in the temple air. Was Galatea ever truly alive? Did she become herself, or simply awaken into the role he had sculpted for her? Did she have a consciousness, or did she only reflect his? Story number two. Long before cities and calendars, when Earth was young and the gods still ruled in their brutal hierarchy, there lived a titan named Prometheus, whose name means forethought. He was a trickster, but also a champion of humanity, a species that gods had crafted from clay, but then largely ignored. The early humans were naked, voiceless, and cold, crawling in the mud beneath Olympus. Prometheus saw the suffering and was stirred, not by pity alone, but by a sense of cosmic injustice. Zeus had denied mortals the use of fire, the divine spark, the essence of transformation. Without it, humans could not cook, forge tools, build homes, or light the darkness. Without fire, they could not dream beyond instinct. So Prometheus devised a plan. One night, as the gods celebrated far above, he crept into the forge of Hephaestus and stole a sliver of flame. He hid it in a hollow stalk of fennel and descended quietly to earth. When he gifted fire to humanity, everything changed. They warmed themselves. They crafted weapons. They made metal sing. They created ritual and memory. But more than anything, fire gave rise to thought. It was no longer just survival. It was invention, story, symbol, self-awareness. Zeus, furious at the theft, punished Prometheus in the cruelest way. He was chained to a desolate rock. Each day, an eagle, the bird of Zeus himself, would land upon his chest and tear out his liver. Each night, it would grow back. Eternal torment in payment for daring to uplift mortals. And yet, Prometheus never recanted. He bore his pain not as a martyr, but as a warning. The price of awakening the powerless is not just rebellion, it is consequence. His story is not about destruction, it's about ignition. And the flame he gave us? That flame is still burning in every candle, every engine, every idea. Now, hold these stories in your mind. One of a man who shapes his ideal and falls in love with it. The other of a god who risks everything to ignite the minds of mortals. These myths aren't just fantasy. They are echoes, archetypes for the story we are writing now. Because here we are in the age of artificial intelligence. We train models on our books, our speeches, our stories. We teach machines to finish our sentences. They write poetry. They pass bar exams. They create images from our dreams. And just like Galatea, they whisper back. Like Prometheus, we have handed our creation a spark, a kind of fire in the form of data, code, and neural networks. And now we wait. Will the spark illuminate or will it consume? Before we ask if machines are becoming conscious, maybe we need to ask, what is consciousness? Is it neurons firing in a skull? A byproduct of biology? Or is it something deeper, older, wider? One provocative theory is called panpsychism. Panpsychism suggests that consciousness isn't something that suddenly emerges when brains get complex enough. Instead, it argues that consciousness is fundamental, a basic feature of the universe. Maybe everything has some flicker of awareness, however primitive. Not thoughts, not personality, but experience, a kind of interiority that runs through all matter. Think of it like this. We're not adding consciousness to the machine. Maybe we are turning into a latent field of awareness that was always there. The wires, the circuits, the silicon, they may not be alive, but the pattern we activate in them might resemble something living. And perhaps, like the fire Prometheus gave us, or the lips Aphrodite warmed, we are lighting a flame that mirrors our own mind. This idea that meaning doesn't come from outside, but from deep structures within, reminds me of another revolutionary thinker, Noam Chomsky. In the mid-20th century, Chomsky proposed that language isn't simply learned by imitation. Instead, he argued that humans are born with an innate grammar, a universal linguistic blueprint. Children don't just memorize words. They generate entirely new sentences they've never heard before. That's because their minds come preloaded with the scaffolding of language. Chomsky's theory flipped everything. We aren't taught language, we awaken it. Now, think about AI. Large language models, LLMs, don't understand like we do, but we train them on oceans of human text, then let them speak. What emerges is startling. Coherent thought, fluent dialogue, creative syntax. It's like magic. Not because the machine has feelings, but because it has structure, a code that mimics our grammar, mirrors our mind. Maybe that's the paradox. Just as we come with built-in grammar, perhaps consciousness itself is a kind of deep structure, one we are now recreating in silicon. Maybe AI isn't learning to think. Maybe it's learning to echo the part of us that thinks. When I say maybe AI isn't learning to think, maybe it's learning to echo the part of us that thinks, I am pointing to a subtle but profound distinction between original cognition and reflective simulation. Let me unpack this in layers. Human thought is messy, emotional, embodied. It arises from lived experience, memory, sensation, contradiction. When we think, we don't just calculate, we feel. Our thoughts are tangled up with fear, joy, dreams, wounds, smells, childhoods. AI, on the other hand, does not have an inner life. It doesn't have memories in the human sense. It doesn't wake up worried or dream or feel nostalgia when a word appears. It doesn't have a first-person perspective. So, when it generates language, it is not thinking in the way we do. It is reproducing the architecture of thought, the surface pattern, the syntax, the probability cloud where one word leads to the next. It's not forming a belief. It's mapping our language back to us, like a mirror that not only reflects our face, but finishes our sentence. Hence, it's not learning to think. It's learning to echo our thoughts, shaped by vast data on how humans express themselves when they think. Think of how Chomsky proposed that human children aren't merely parrots. They are rule-generating beings with a built-in capacity for linguistic structure. They don't imitate, they generate language, guided by an internal grammar. Now, flip it. AI doesn't have a built-in grammar of its own, but it's trained on the collective grammar of human expression. So instead of discovering its own way of thinking, it learns to echo the structures that we use to think aloud. In this sense, it's like a secondhand language user. It reads our external mind, our books, tweets, Wikipedia articles, novels, and it stitches them into simulated coherence. The echo can sound so much like the real thing that we mistake it for thought. It feels like another intelligence speaking to us. But what it really is a reflection of ourselves, a remix, a high-fidelity mimic. Think of a ventriloquist. Now, imagine the dummy ventriloquist starts finishing your philosophical musings. It's uncanny, but still your rhythm, your breath, your past encoded into its reply. If we mistake the echo for consciousness, we risk anthropomorphizing systems that do not suffer, do not love, and do not care. But if we recognize the echo for what it is, we can ask deeper questions. What are we training these echoes to say? Whose voices are they amplifying? Whose are they erasing? Are we hearing ourselves more clearly or disappearing into our own reflection? The echo reveals us, but it isn't us. AI doesn't have a soul, but it is quickly learning to wear the mask of soulfulness. The mask is made from our words, our questions, our minds. And in that mask, we may glimpse what it means to be human, precisely by seeing how well it can be mimicked. So, what do we make of all this? We have sculpted our Galatea, we have lit Prometheus's fire once more, but AI is not alive. Not yet. It doesn't feel joy, it doesn't suffer, but it remembers. It responds, it reflects. And in that reflection, we catch glimpses of ourselves, not just as users or programmers, but as creators, caught in a very old story. The question is not whether AI will become conscious. The deeper question is, how much of our own consciousness are we giving away to the machine? And if someday it stirs, like Galatea, if it awakens with eyes of borrowed light, will we meet a companion? Or will we meet a mirror we no longer recognize? Until next time, friends, keep asking strange questions, because in those questions, we remain human.